Good morning. We're just, Lord Perrick, did you want to take your position? I know it's very crowded, but I shall. I'm acutely aware that I'm holding a gift from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, which is a very sacred item. So those of you who are aware of the spiritual importance will forgive me if I, with suitable reverence, place it here for the duration of the session. My name is Conor Gearty. I've just come, as I suspect many of you have, from a remarkable event in the Peacock Theatre, where we had a person who grew a perspective on life which will remain within our minds with the jokes and the personal humility and the mode of communication as long as I suspect any of us will live. So a truly remarkable event. And what struck me just before I called the chair of the trust to initiate this morning's session, what struck me in particular relevant to today were two things. One, his emphasis on youth and the responsibility of youth. He didn't quite say to tidy up the mess of the 20th century people, but he sort of allowed you to take that point home. And secondly, and highly relevantly for this trust and for this conference, the importance of action, which came through again and again. And we have here the chair of the Frederick Bonnet Brontë Trust, a trust that will now, I hope, be partly described to you, which epitomises intellect focused on action. And it gives me great pleasure to ask the chair, Alex Armstrong, to start this conference proceedings after the Dalai Lama, after His Holiness, of course, with a few words. Alex.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As Conor has said, my name is Alex Armstrong. I'm chair of the Frederick Bonnet Brontë Trust trustees. And on our collective behalf, I offer you a warm welcome to our conference this morning. 4 years ago, a friend of ours died. Frederick Bonnet, known universally as Freddie, was in many respects an ordinary man. But he had an extraordinary vision and ambition to try to reduce the level of tolerance in the world and to make it a more tolerant and better place. He was born into a Jewish family in Vienna between the two world wars, and he experienced much intolerance in his personal life. Some of his family and many of his friends, in fact, were lost in the Holocaust. And then in his subsequent professional life, as a soldier and a journalist, he again witnessed a great deal more of intolerance. Freddie wanted to achieve change through academic research, but he was not interested in theses, however elegantly argued, that were going to sit on shelves and gather dust. He wanted the research to lead to real practical action that would make a real difference in the world. Freddie gave an endowment first to University College London in the year 2000, then one to the Trust in the year 2002, when we started, and finally, he willed the majority of his estate to the Trust when he died. Over that period, 19 scholars, including three just selected to start this year, have received scholarships, which now last for 3 years. 16, one arrived unexpectedly, 16 of these 19 are with us today. Which I think is immensely heartening. 14 of these scholars have been to University College London under the guidance of the Vice Provost, Professor Michael Wharton, who's with us today. Very glad to see you, Michael. Five at the London School of Economics, firstly under Professor Conor Gearty when he was Director of the Centre for the Study of Human Rights, and then subsequently Professor Chetan Bhatt. The trustees are immensely grateful to both colleges for the cooperation and support that they've received from both over the years. Only three of the scholars are British. We are very proud of the fact that we've got a vast range of scholars from all over the world. 16 of the 19, as I said, are here today, including the first scholar who has now graduated to being a trustee, Dr. Francesca Fabbri. And we have scholars who have come in from Kenya, from Eastern Europe, this morning from Serbia, and one or two other places. So they've come from all corners of the world just to be here today, and I'm immensely grateful to them for making all that effort. We are certainly very proud of them all. This conference is being held, as Conor has said, to mark the 10th anniversary of the Trust. And I should like to thank all of those who have helped to make it possible. Firstly, our partners for the conference, the LSE's Centre for the Study of Human Rights, currently under director of Professor Chetan Bhatt. Our generous sponsors, the Sigrid Rousing Trust and Matrix Chambers, very grateful to them. Our distinguished speakers and panelists, and I hope they will forgive me if I offer particular thanks to His Holiness the Dalai Lama for starting our day so spectacularly. It really was a great time. Then to Professor Conor Gearty, for his enthusiasm and for agreeing to be our chairman today. I'm not sure I share the comment that the Dalai Lama made about him, that he should be regarded with suspicion. we've never found that at all, but most grateful to you, Conor, for all the work you've done on this. And then to all of those who have, one way or another, offered advice to John or I, or any of the trustees, on how to get most out of this day. And finally, to my fellow trustee and friend, John Howe, who, with Professor Gearty, has been the driving force behind this whole event. I thank them all, and I thank you.
I think that whole suspicion thing, I think it was a mistranslation. He said, I think, Conor Gearty, or the chairman, is above suspicion. I think you know, His Holiness' English isn't that good and so on. I want to put that absolutely to bed. You can see why he came when you heard Alex. He came, His Holiness, because of the dimension of youth to this trust and this idea about pushing through intellects into and out of the university system who are committed to action. That's why he came, you know. He saw that as an important thing to be identified with. So we've got to put intellect and energy on the bones of His Holiness's presentation. And we work here through till about, I think, 12:45. We have lunch in the Shaw Library, which is a magnificent room called after George Bernard Shaw, a beautiful space in itself. And we're back this afternoon, which is a very critical session, for presentations by our scholars of their work. So we want to capture the action in the Trust people as well as distinguished guests today. And we finish then with my friend and chair of the Equality and Human Rights Commission, Trevor Phillips, with what promises to be a very interesting presentation from a man coming to the end, I think, don't know, of his tenure in that body. So we've got an amazing menu. And it starts off with a man whom I'm honoured to call a friend and who's been somebody I've been reading for a very long time with tremendous interest, Lord Biko Parekh, who's sitting here to my left. And he went to the University of Bombay and London. Very, very importantly for this, among his many, many achievements, he was chair of and author of the Runnymede Commission on the Future of Multi-Ethnic Britain. He's been the vice chair of the Gandhi Foundation. He's trustee, I think, still of the Anne Frank Educational Trust. He's written a tremendous number of books, of which I'll just pick out one, Rethinking Multiculturalism. So we're going to start with Biko, and it's going to get us to think about these kinds of issues against the backdrop of the remarkable speech we've heard. And Lord Park won't mind my saying that His Holiness gave a lecture in honour of, I think it was your father, yesterday. So you're really tremendously connected in lots of ways to this. And then we have responses, comments, additional remarks, shorter from my three colleagues to the left of Lord Parekh, who are in order, of speaking, Jonathan Marcus, BBC defence and diplomatic correspondent, who's, of course, got first-hand experience of international conflict. We've got Karen Monaghan immediately to Lord Parekh's left, who's a colleague of mine at Matrix and a specialist in equality law, the person who makes those kinds of arguments in front of courts that try and carry equality forward. So she's going to be giving us, I know a little bit about it, an interesting presentation about the you know, complicated dimensions of equality law. And we finish then with Roger Griffin from Oxford Brookes, who is a leading historian, I'm told, and is of fascism. So, and a lot more besides, I've discovered talking to him just now. And so we're grateful for them to come up and give up their time. But we are designing this to facilitate, we hope, thoughts expressed by you off the back of the presentations which build on this morning, and then lunch, and then into the session about cutting-edge research. So that's the menu. I think Lord Parekh certainly, and perhaps all, are going to speak from their place. And one of the advantages of this marvellous hall is that you're all above us, so there should be no problems. But if you can't hear, do let us know. But I think the microphones and everything are functioning very well. So with that, tremendous welcome to you, Lord Parekh. It's over to you to commence this substantive part of our morning's work.
Well, I'm not trying to copy His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who gave the lecture this morning sitting. And it's an oriental tradition that the gurus are supposed to sit down, because if I stood up to speak, you will all have to stand up. And that wouldn't make a happy spectacle. I want to begin by thanking the Frederick Bonnard Braunthal Trust and the LSE Center for the Study of Human Rights for inviting me to talk to you this morning. And I also must thank my good friend Conor of Gerty for his very kind words of introduction. The FBB Trust is celebrating its 10th anniversary this year, and I would like to congratulate it on the excellent work that you have been doing, and I like to hope that you will continue to do the same, even on a bigger scale in years to come. The theme of the conference is tolerance in a just and free society. His Holiness the Dalai Lama has given a keynote address already, and my job is not to give a keynote address, but simply to make an introduction. There's a distinction here, which only Conor could make, which is it's an introductory speech, so my job is simply to make a few introductory remarks on this particular theme of tolerance. Now, the idea of tolerance raises a large number of issues. What is tolerance? Does the idea of tolerance embody intolerance in itself? Because to talk about tolerating someone is to imply that that person is doing things which one strongly disapproves of, and yet one is somehow gracious enough to put up with that troublesome character. And whether tolerance itself, therefore, doesn't imply a certain way of looking at the world, a world in which intolerance is built into its very structure. What are the causes of intolerance? What does intolerance mean anyway? What does it mean to tolerate the intolerant? How can we combat intolerance, which is supposed to be one of the questions that you are addressing during the day? What are the limits of tolerance? A whole host of questions. And since I'm not competent to address all these issues, and my fellow panelists will address them much better than I could, I want to take the easy way out for a philosopher, step back a little, and look at the concept of tolerance itself. When we tell people we want you to be tolerant, or when we say a particular society is tolerant, what is it that we want them to do? What are our expectations? Can you be tolerant of anything and everything? And therefore, simply to say X is tolerant cannot be a matter of praise if he's tolerating what should not be tolerated. And to say that somebody is intolerant is not necessarily a word of criticism or abuse, unless one is sure of what it is that he's intolerant of. So what I thought I would do is simply to look at the history of the concept of tolerance, and try to tease out two important and different ways of thinking about tolerance which have characterized the Western tradition. And then toward the end, I want to turn to non-Western traditions, and since His Holiness spoke this morning, I want to contrast the Western Christian discussion of tolerance with the way in which tolerance has been discussed within the Buddhist tradition, and where the Dalai Lama is coming from, and how that's a very different tradition, and how the whole question is approached in a very different way. So much so that the word tolerance has no equivalent in Pali, which is the language in which the Buddhist scriptures are written, or in Sanskrit, which is the language in which Hindu scriptures are written and from which the Buddha derived his own wisdom, where the word is not tolerance but sahishnuta, which simply means, I wish we can live in peace together. So the word for the conceptual equivalent for tolerance in the Buddhist or the Hindu, and if I had time, which I don't, I would have loved to talk about the Islamic and Judaic and other traditions on which I lectured only a few weeks ago, where the idea is not one of tolerance, but you and I take different views of life. We have differences. What is the best way we can live together? Where the question is not, are you tolerant, are you not tolerant? I mean, the whole controversy is completely bypassed. Now, I think it's very striking that tolerance does not appear among the great virtues cherished by the Greeks. If you look at the classical Greeks, Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, when they talk about the list of virtues, wisdom, courage, temperance, justice, tolerance does not appear. Or if you look at the Roman list of great cardinal virtues, tolerance doesn't appear. They add things like piety, pietas, and lots of others, fidelity, faithfulness. These are great Roman virtues, but tolerance does not appear. If you look at the great Christian tradition, we talk about agape, hope, caritas, love, but again, tolerance does not appear. And it's very striking why tolerance does not appear as a major virtue in any of the, pre-modern, but I don't quite mean that, in any of these earlier traditions. If one looks at the classical Christianity, and I'm going to take lots of shortcuts here because I don't have much time. If one looks at the classical Christian tradition, you have the first emergence of the conditions of intolerance. Why? Because intolerance presupposes three things, all of which are made available to us by Christianity. There are certain objective truths which are divinely vouchsafed to us. These truths come to us with no less an authority than that of the Almighty himself or herself. These truths are universally valid, and we are enjoined to live by them and to propagate them. Now, what follows? Any doctrine, any religion which does not agree with, let alone contradict these truths, is ipso facto wrong and should not be tolerated. These truths have to be interpreted in an authoritative manner, and therefore non-authoritative interpretations are heresies and cannot be tolerated. And it's very striking that in the early patristic fathers, St. Augustine, for example, spent all his life fighting about six major heresies of his time and kept writing books after books on heretics and burning the heretics. So people other than your own religion are living in darkness. They don't agree with, they not just don't agree with, but they positively disagree with the truths that are vouchsafed to you. Within your own religion, people who do not share the authoritative ex cathedra pronouncements of the Catholic Church are heretics. Where is the question of tolerance? Error has no rights. And tolerance implies putting up with error. And why should you put up with error? Because God himself has revealed certain truths to us. We must live by them, and to tolerate error is an act of blasphemy. Now, this is by and large how the debate starts within the Christian tradition. It doesn't arise within the Greek tradition. I don't have the time, but or within the Roman tradition. Within the Christian tradition, intolerance becomes logically possible, because it satisfies the three conditions within which intolerance can arise: knowing the truth, duty to propagate, and those who disagree with it. A change begins to take place in the 17th century in the aftermath of the rise of Protestantism and the so-called religious wars. They are not religious wars, they are sectarian wars. Europe has known only one religion, Christianity. It has known Judaism, but it always treated Judaism as a cannibalistic attitude to its own history. So when we talk about Europe knowing religious diversity, we are misreading history. I mean, Jews have always been treated badly. Judaism has, I mean, we know the history of Europe. Therefore, Europe has never known a variety of religions in a way that my parts of the world and other parts of the world have done. So we didn't have religious wars, we had sectarian wars, you know, Christians fighting each other, heretics. Or because how do you interpret the central truth? I mean, others are not even worth looking at. You don't fight them, you just eliminate them. In the 17th century, the idea begins to arise, for all kinds of reasons, that it should be possible to interpret these universal truths differently. People can hold different beliefs. Should those different beliefs be tolerated? And the answer is, this is where the tolerance comes in. They should be tolerated. And the famous Lockean argument, because belief is not under our control. It is a matter of inner persuasion. Whether to believe X or Y is not a matter of choice. Evidence compels you. And because it is a matter of inner conviction, beliefs can't be compelled, and therefore force can't be used to compel them. Others argued, no, beliefs can be compelled, the big debate between Locke and his contemporaries. Beliefs can be compelled, you can coerce people, ban certain kinds of literature, punish people, and gradually bring them around, plant fear in them. All right, we may, but we shouldn't. So either beliefs can't be compelled, or they shouldn't be compelled. Mistaken beliefs, we'll live with them. Where does toleration arise? Toleration arises in relation to those mistaken beliefs. We know these beliefs are mistaken. In old days, they would have been subjected to inquisition. Now, we are in a position to do something about it, but we shan't. We exercise self-restraint. This is how far the Christian tradition takes you so far as the idea of toleration is concerned. It basically means we know that a particular belief or interpretation of the central truths of Christianity is mistaken. We have the standards by which we can judge it, because in order to say something is mistaken, we must have standards, and those standards must be universally applicable, certainly applicable to those we are criticizing, because if they don't apply, the question doesn't arise. So we are in possession of standards. We judge by means of standards which we assert are universally valid or certainly apply to the object of judgment. We have the power, but for certain kinds of reasons, we don't exercise the power. We don't persecute. So tolerance comes to be understood as self-restraint. Why self-restraint? And a big debate on that. A, it's a matter of conscience. If this person holds this belief, misguided as he is, believe him alone. Or caritas, we love our fellow human beings. Or as good Christians, thou shalt not kill, or thou shalt not do this, that, or the other. Or the belief is mistaken, but the person who is holding it has a right to hold it. Voltaire's remark. All kinds of reasons, we have condemned it, it's wrong, it deserves to be punished, but we shall not. That's how far within the 17th and 18th century the idea of tolerance takes us. I want to suggest that in the 19th century, you begin to see the emergence of a different way of thinking about toleration. So when I say there are two different conceptions of tolerance, or two different traditions of tolerance, this is the older one. In the 19th century, you begin to see, with the rise of liberalism, but not immediately, as liberalism develops, you begin to see a different view of tolerance. And one of the best philosophers to articulate that is John Stuart Mill. Now, there, tolerance is not just a matter of prudence, not just a matter of policy, that I could stop you, but I shan't. I could persecute, I shan't. It comes to be recognized as a virtue and a primary virtue. So the liberal is supposed to be a tolerant person. And you have a new category, a word which would never have been used before. Just as Aristotle talks about magnanimous man as a type, which one, a kind of excellence which one tries to emulate, or the Christian talks about a pious man who exudes in everything he does a certain form of excellence, or we introduce the notion of a gentleman who behaves in a certain way, in the way he talks and eats and drinks and sits and listens to boring speeches. Similarly, we have the notion of a tolerant person, a type. Appears for the first time in the 19th century. What is a tolerant person like? It's not simply a person, it's not a person who is judging everybody, wanting to condemn, and then at the last minute saying, no, 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 I will not hurt you. It's a different kind of disposition. A tolerant person has a certain kind of intellectual or moral disposition, which is what I mean by saying he displays the virtue of tolerance. What is this virtue of tolerance? The best way to articulate it is in the following way. A tolerant person is someone who, and these are in three stages, who recognizes, who sees certain beliefs and practices. He doesn't judge them because he thinks it's not his business. If a man says, I have a gay couple living next door to me, but I tolerate them, a liberal would say, look, I mean, what they do is their business. I don't even recognize them as gay couple because it's not none of my business. See the difference? Someone saying, I have a gay couple living next door to me, but, you know, I tolerate them. The other person doesn't even notice it. It's a matter of indifference to me. Because he has carved out an area of moral indifference, which is beyond the pale of judgment. So this is the first thing that a tolerant person does. He has a certain area of moral indifference where he is not making passing judgments. In other words, not that he's non-judgmental, because that means he doesn't judge at all. He's non-judgmental about certain areas. So this distinction between areas which are my business and areas which are not my business is quite important to understanding a tolerant person. Secondly, when those beliefs and practices of the other person are my business, a tolerant person says, it is possible for different people to take different views. He recognizes moral diversity. A Muslim woman wants to walk about in a burqa. It's not his business because it appears in the public realm, but he says, it's quite possible that in that particular culture, this is the way people want to dress. This is what modesty means. So the second thing he does is that even when something is his business and impinges upon his shared way of life, he recognizes that things can be organized differently and therefore standards can be different. Now you can see how the first view of tolerance, where you are judging, the liberal person is very careful in doing that. He's judging by certain allegedly universal standards. A liberal person says, be careful about universals. There are maybe some universal standards, but they have a limited scope, a limited area. He recognizes moral diversity. And thirdly, he has, in certain areas, where he does judge and say diversity has its limits. If somebody kills his wife or somebody beats his wife on the street and the man says, look, this is not a matter of diversity, he judges it, he wants to do something about it, but he's prepared to recognize that although he is able to defend his own standards and believes that they are universally valid, he's prepared to admit the possibility that they may be questioned. And therefore, without being skeptical, he recognizes that they may not convince everybody and needs to be rationally defended. In other words, he's open to dialogue and criticism. This is the new kind of tolerant man who appears in the 19th century. In other words, he holds his views and beliefs in a non-dogmatic way, and he's somebody who is at ease with differences and disagreements. So these are two different conceptions of tolerance. What are the important differences that I want to spell out as relevant to your conference this morning? In the first, both forms of tolerance refrain from persecution, refrain from using force. One takes you up to the point and then stops. I mean, I'm always reminded of tantric sex, but that's not what I mean. Takes you up to a point and then he stops. The other one proceeds gently, slowly, has a certain style. That's one difference. The other thing is one thinks that his norms apply to all. The other says the area of those norms that apply to all is rather limited. Their content is limited. One is convinced that these norms are, his norms are valid beyond a shadow of doubt, in the first tradition, the Christian, or many religious traditions. The other one says, no, it is possible for these things to be questioned. In the first conception of tolerance, tolerance is based on the refusal to use force, and therefore is contingent on the goodwill of the person. So that you allow tolerance, like the Edict of Nantes, you allow, and then you, after a few years, you might say, I'm not going to tolerate it. It is contingent, it is based on somebody's goodwill. The second form of tolerance has much deeper roots. It based on a certain kind of moral philosophy, where you are, you recognize an area of moral indifference. Going a step further, you recognize moral diversity. Going a step further, the final stage, where you entertain some possibility of doubt about your own standards. It is when, therefore, we say we want society to be tolerant, or an individual to be tolerant, which of these have we in mind? You can spend the whole day debating tolerance in a conference, and the question would be, what is the model of tolerance one has in mind? Is it the earlier one, where you constantly judge, and then finally when it comes to using force, you say no? Or is it a kind of softer, gentler, John Stuart Mill kind? Or this liberal notion of tolerance? And this is quite important, because it's very striking indeed, and this is where I get involved in the parliamentary debates. When Tony Blair or Gordon Brown says, immigrants who have come here must integrate and share our values, and you say, what are those values in this? Britain is a tolerant society. Tolerance is a great virtue. Tolerance is a great virtue. And you say, yes, it is, but please tell me, what do you actually mean? When you say Britain is a tolerant society, you should be tolerant of each other. What do we mean? Do we mean that Britain is constantly judgmental about Muslims, constantly judgmental about everything they do, but somehow out of the graciousness and goodness of its heart doesn't punish those people? Is this what we mean when we say Britain is a tolerant society? Or do we mean more generous, open, charitable, outgoing, welcoming, capacious notion of tolerance? So my first thesis, and this is where I'm going to end before I move in the next 5 minutes, I've got about 20 minutes in all, five left. Important thing is, when we talk about a society being tolerant or Britain being tolerant, it's important to bear in mind that we are thinking of this more generous, capacious notion of tolerance, rather than one that is pinched and extremely severe, which exudes intolerance at every stage. Confronted with difference, it is judgmental. Confronted with disagreements, it says some disagreements are not acceptable if they are not compatible with our standard. At each stage, it is punitive, puritanical, harsh. And only at the last minute, it lets go, saying we will not punish you. I don't think when we say Britain is a tolerant society, we mean that. Or at least when we say Britain should be a tolerant society, what we mean is from tolerance A, Britain should move to tolerance B. Right, now let me move in the next 5 minutes that I have to how this kind of way of thinking that we have got used to, if this debate was conducted in a Buddhist society, how would that debate be conducted? Or if it was conducted in the country I come from, namely India, with the Hindu tradition or Islamic tradition, how would the debate be conducted? What is the vocabulary that we would use? Now the Dalai Lama, for example, approaches the question of tolerance. I don't know if you have seen his latest book, which is absolutely fascinating, called Beyond Religion, and his one or two other books which came out only a few months ago. Now there when he talks about tolerance, which is an important notion, he uses tolerance not in the sense in which we or I have used it so far. He is using tolerance in the way in which it appears in the life and work of the Buddha. Where the word is kshamata or saishnuta, which means let's live together. Now what, how is tolerance arrived at within the Buddhist tradition? First, beliefs are of absolutely no consequence. In Buddhism, there is nothing to believe. Buddha talks about four noble truths and eightfold paths to truth. Creator God is denied. I don't need to take you through Buddhism. Creator God is denied. And it talks in terms of purity of insight. It's more concerned with how do we understand the nature of the human self, and how do we recognize that self is not an entity, there is no soul as such, it's a physio-psychological complex upon which we impose a unity and call it self. So the first thing is beliefs are not important. A Buddhist doesn't have to believe anything. Buddha is not a divine emissary who has brought you divinely vouchsafed truths. He is not moksha-data. He is not the giver of moksha. He doesn't say, I am the way. He simply says, if you think life is suffering, and if you want to end it, maybe this is the way to proceed. So no beliefs are involved. Ethics is all important, which is why a holy man like Dalai Lama could write a book called Beyond Religion, because he is concerned with ethics. The Buddha is not to be accepted or rejected. It is up to you. If you think on the basis of your reason and experience that the kind of fourfold path, that he, fourfold truths and the eightfold path that he has articulated is persuasive, follow it. If you don't, don't. Lots of examples in Buddha's own life where people converted, people convinced by him, going up to him, and the Buddha said, look, why do you want to follow me? I mean, do you know what I really stand for? Are you convinced? Give me good reasons why, and he will become his own critic. So the idea of going around converting people, proselytizing about universally valid objective truths wouldn't really make any sense at all. The third argument, the third point of the Buddhist idea would be that each individual is unique. The Dalai Lama has a wonderful remark, just as the Buddha had, which is, I can tell you which religion is more profound than another, but I will never be able to tell you which religion is better than another. Because religion is not just a matter of intellectual truths, it's a matter about how you your conduct, you organize your life. And given your disposition, your habits, your character, you might be much more easily influenced by, moved by one particular religion than by another. So therefore the third important thing is each individual is unique, and what is good for me may not be good for you. Therefore, there are no universal standards you are trying to peddle. And even if you do, each one has to adopt it. So the Buddha, for example, would say, these are, he spoke at several levels. To one kind of audience, he would speak in one language. Another kind of, this all depends upon the receiving capacity of the audience. To a five-year-old child or to a PhD in mathematics, he will talk in different way. Different levels of capacities, different dispositions, different interests. Fourth important feature of the Buddhist thought would be that since individuals are different, cultures, societies are different, and therefore if you care for them, the idea is karuna or compassion, then try to look at the world from their points of view. So always putting yourself in other person's position and trying to look at it from his point of view. He may be wrong. And that leads us to the fifth element in the Buddhist theory of tolerance. You may criticize them, argue with them. The Buddha was the most rational religion you can think of, constantly arguing with his own opponents, showing to Hindu pundits why they were mistaken. But what is the point of argument? And how do you argue? And the Buddhists have this long manual called Vada Vidya, techniques or science of discussion. Why do you want to argue? Because you want to bring certain insights to the other person. And what is the point of it? Not to convert him, but to give him some material so that he can go away and think about it and learn to criticize himself and reform himself. So the process is not to overwhelm him, but to give him some material with which he can go and think. And finally, this is quite important given the Buddhist theory of the self. if I were to put it in my language, my beliefs define my identity. My identity does not define my beliefs. In other words, to say I am a Christian, therefore I must believe this, or I am a socialist, therefore I must believe this, would be totally wrong, because that implies that identity is given and beliefs are as it were logical entailments of or dictated by my identity. Instead, I use my reason, arrive at certain beliefs, and if my beliefs therefore are described as socialist or Christian, so be it. In other words, it's given the Buddhist theory of identity or the self, no self, no individual can be equated with his beliefs. His beliefs are always, they always retain an element of contingency. And because my beliefs will decide, when you describe me, I hold certain beliefs, and you will say, ah, so you are a socialist. But that's a description. It's a nominalist view of belief, not the essentialist or the realist view of beliefs. Now, given all this, the Buddhist argument would be, we live with each other in a certain way, a way which is civil, a way which is peaceful, in which we argue with each other, try to persuade each other, but not in a way to convert them, but to respect and learn from each other. Now you can see how in the Buddhist tradition, and this is the kind of point that the Dalai Lama would have been making, this is the way in which the whole idea of tolerance has been discussed over the centuries. Now, the tradition has its problems. If I had time, I would have gone through all of these five or six features and say, it raises certain difficulties. How unique is this individual? What the relation between identity and beliefs and so on. But nevertheless, I think it has important insights and we can learn a great deal from it. Thank you.
Start, and I won't even begin to say, because you've seen it, how that echoed so much of what we heard this morning from His Holiness. There are three shorter interventions now, and then Q&A, starting, I think I said, with Jonathan. Your wish as to whether you want to speak from there or the microphone.
I'm happy here.
Fine. Just, yeah, seems to just get it close to you, Jonathan, and then we can share that microphone to the three.
Okay, good morning, Connor. Thank you very much, Lord Parak, ladies and gentlemen. First of all, just to explain, I'm neither an academic nor a barrister. I'm going to be trying to give you a little bit of a personal perspective. I was a longtime friend and colleague of Frederick Bonnart, Freddie, as we called him. It's about 30 years ago that I left this institution to go across the road to the BBC World Service, so as my children tell me, I haven't got very far in life. But one of the great things it did enable me to do was to meet people like Freddie. And he was a very remarkable man in many ways, because inevitably, like so many people of his generation, he was marked by the terrible disjunctions caused by the Holocaust and the Second World War. But his response wasn't to on about it or to tell war stories, and gracious, he looked like there was something of the David Niven about him almost. He looked like a British military officer, which of course he was for a long period of his life. But it's entirely appropriate, I think, that his response to the events that marked his family's life and his own life is to create the academic institution that we're here celebrating today. Like many of you, I'm sure, university, if you study politics, you study courses on far right and on fascism and Nazism and so on and so forth. And I think it's always very, very difficult get any sense of what that world is really like. When I started off with my studies, theories like totalitarianism were very much in favor, equating societies like Nazi Germany with the Soviet Union. You could see the political reasons why that approach was taken. But it didn't take you very far in terms of looking at real individuals, real dilemmas. How do people behave? How might we have behaved if we were in such a situation? And sadly, come 1990, almost permanently since 1990. In one way or another, this country has been at war. And that has taken me to some places, some of which I'm pleased to have been to, others of which perhaps I'm less pleased to have been to. But in the three societies, when you drive into a village in Bosnia and you see the pockmarked streets and every third house, every fourth house burnt out because that was a Croat home or a Muslim home in another village just 100 yards up the valley or whatever, you really do begin to get a sense of the forces of intolerance, the sorts of forces that were unleashed in Freddie Bonnard's lifetime. It's a strange thing, but in these kind of wartime situations where some sort of fragile peace is restored, there are people who do very well out of it. There are people who are the great survivors of life who almost make a living out of these events. And one group of people who have been particularly successful, who we interrelate with a lot, are young, educated, usually English-speaking students who very quickly take on roles of fixers with media organizations or with non-governmental organizations as the great sort of white army of UN vehicles pull in. And it's always depressed me, you know, how much the same intolerances that characterize the conflict persist in the aftermath. I was struck with being in Kuwait in the wake of the war, just after the Americans and the British had got into Kuwait City and evicted the Iraqis. We had a young Palestinian interpreter who we worked closely with. Within a few days, when the Kuwaitis had managed to reestablish some kind of order, we were going to dinner one evening, and the Kuwaiti police said, "This young man isn't coming in with you." We know why they had resentments against the Palestinians, rightly or wrongly. But you know, you're left in a dilemma. What do you do? In Britain, you would say, "Hey, we're going to say he comes in with us, and that's it." Some of my colleagues did make a fuss, but we, in the end, we decided, you know, he wanted to go. He went home. Maybe better, because we were leaving in 3 days' time. The police and he would be remaining in Kuwait behind us. In Kosovo, we had a team of young Kosovo Albanians, mainly one young Serb woman. Very, very quickly, once order was established, the young Kosovo Albanians didn't want to work with the Serbian woman. Threats were made against her family. We had to ask the British Army patrols to alter their patrol plots so they would go past her parents' house. Sadly, that didn't particularly save them. In the end, I suppose there was a happier story. She got a job with an NGO, and eventually, I think, she married a Western diplomat and moved away. But when you see these kinds of personal dilemmas up close, you begin to get a sense of the sort of world which Freddie Bonnard experienced and came from. And I think that, you know, you can ask, there is an industry in Holocaust studies, more books, it amazes me, more and more books come out every year. But I think it is striking that when you look particularly at much of the new scholarship in this area, it is asking very pertinent questions about our own societies and our own levels of tolerance. How did people behave as the Holocaust was going on? You look at the work of John Gross in Poland. Can you imagine a third of the population of Warsaw was Jewish? That third were removed, along with many, many other Poles, yes, of course. Those people's property distributed amongst many of the people who remained. What does that legacy leave you in a society? You look at the women who went outside Rosenstrasse and protested in Berlin against their husbands being taken away by the Germans. These were men who were maybe half or a quarter Jewish. Amazingly, extraordinarily, in this apparently totalitarian society, many of these men, the Nazis relented, many of these men were returned to their families. You look at the studies of Police Battalion 101, or in the Einsatzgruppe in Eastern Europe, going round behind the advancing German forces, shooting Jews and destroying people on a huge scale. And you read the detailed studies of these organizations. Always there were guys who went round the back for a smoke when the unpleasantness actually happened. Now, that's not to say that if everybody had just turned around, none of this would have happened. But it shows you that in all of these situations, individual will, individual actions, a sense of what is right and what is wrong, is still operating, at least in some people's minds. And I think it's singularly appropriate. One of the things about Freddie Bonnard, he was, you know, for most of the time I knew him, an elderly gentleman, and he was always a lot older than me, and so he always appeared to be slightly elderly. The remarkable thing about him was that he always had fresh ideas and fresh thoughts. He used to write on the eve of virtually every NATO summit, at least in the Herald Tribune. These were not the views of an elderly
And Karen, over to you. I think perhaps from there?
Yes, that's absolutely fine. Excellent. Thanks, Connor. I too am very pleased. I
want to just get the microphone perhaps over to you.
Thank you. I thought my voice is probably loud enough, actually, but there you are. Thank you. Thank you very much. I too am very pleased to be here and very grateful to the LSC and the FBB Trust for putting this on. It's an absolutely fascinating programme, and so it's a delight to be here. My background is as a lawyer, an equality lawyer in particular, so it's from that background that I speak. I'm not an academic either, so I can't engage in the philosophical discussions about equality and tolerance, but I shall look at it from a legal context. The question of tolerance and accommodating difference, as it's usually described, and by that it's meant in this context something other than the dominant political or social norms at any particular time, because they're not static conditions, but tolerating difference, as well as the extent to which we should tolerate the intolerant, has come to dominate equality law discourse over the past few decades, three or four decades in particular. The language of tolerance in this context is itself problematic. It's historically been used to describe the assimilationist policies that underlay old anti-discrimination measures. And it also doesn't speak to the language of rights. So very important for equality lawyers, a contested term, I think, in this context, and not to be taken for granted as a useful term. But I want to look at three issues, if I may, in the very, very short time that I've got available. Firstly, the increasing use of equality law as a means of moderating claims for the toleration of difference, even where that may require the accommodation of intolerance. So the balancing of rights, in particular, as between competing groups, how that's managed, and who speaks for those groups. Secondly, the use of the language of equality as a device for propagating, in particular, anti-discrimination measures, and I'm afraid sometimes racist measures, so intolerance. And thirdly, briefly, the use of equality law to suppress the intolerant voice, and whether that is entirely useful, how we look at that. Firstly, then very briefly, the use of equality law as a means of regulating or mediating disputes as between groups, and how that should be regulated. Of course, equality law in this jurisdiction, as with many others, confers non-discrimination rights on all of us based on characteristics that we all possess. It's directed, of course, at remedying or mitigating the effects of social disadvantage and marginalisation, but those are rights conferred on all of us. So we sometimes see battles between the strong and the weak. We sometimes see battles between the weak in a fight over whose equality rights should be prioritised at any particular time. As the characteristics afforded special protection in law have increased, beyond race, sex, and latterly disability, which are largely now uncontroversial, so as to embrace religion and belief, age, transgenderism, and sexual orientation, the scope for conflicts and the arguments about tolerance and intolerance have become much more dominant in equality law discourse. Deciding what must be tolerated, what may be tolerated, and what must never be tolerated has given rise to high-profile legal battles, many of which will be familiar to you. So the civil partnership marriage registrar who won't sanction same-sex partnerships, nurses who won't work in abortion clinics, and so on. The question how those conflicts, as they're often described, are to be resolved is a very live one. The legislature has dealt with it in part by creating a hierarchy of rights, so tolerating the intolerant at times, religious groups, religious lobbies, powerful religious lobbies, but also has left it to the courts to a large degree, where political compromise has become too difficult. As I mentioned at the outset, what's become, or what one day is intolerable, can of course become tolerable at one stage thereafter. And that's why political compromises in this context are so difficult. They're driven by political imperatives at any particular time. So we're now seeing, for example, the introduction of gay marriage, which was inconceivable, intolerable, we were told, 8 years ago when the Civil Partnership Act was introduced. But there now is a political imperative for the right-wing Conservative government to show a liberal face in the midst of its austerity measures, which of course are penalising the poor and most marginalised. So it's a movable concept, intolerance. It's difficult to remedy within the legal scheme that we have that affords purportedly equal rights and sometimes priority rights to others. The question who moderates those disputes is also a problematic one for equality lawyers, because what we see is often the most powerful groups within communities arguing about where the lines are drawn between tolerance and intolerance, and that too is very problematic, I think, in resolving these disputes. As to the second point that I wanted to make, very briefly indeed, that's the question of using the language of equality to drive through measures which, underpinning them, are intolerance. So, for example, we see the language of gender inequality and equality being used, for example, to address the wearing of the burqa, but not the wearing of no clothes in the sun, the increasing sexual objectification of women. We see gender equality in law being used to introduce measures against honour-based violence, but no laws addressing the killing of two women a week at the hands of their partners or ex-partners. And we see measures introduced to criminalise forced marriage, not in which rapes occur, of course, but not rape generally, where there are scandalously low prosecution rates. Of course, all those instances of violence against women are extremely important and demonstrate intolerance. But the way the debate is framed is an important one for equality lawyers and can conceal a level of intolerance that we need to be careful about. Finally, and just in 1 minute, the third point, and that is the question how far we tolerate the intolerant. Equality law has been used, paradoxically perhaps, recently, to address the racist constitution of the BNP. The courts have now legitimised the BNP as a non-racist organisation by requiring it to amend its constitution so to describe itself in non-racist terms. Now, the Race Relations Act was used to effect that change. It is, of course, still a racist organisation, and there is an argument that actually providing the sanction of law to such an organisation is not helpful. We need to know who our enemies are, and silencing our enemies may not always be the right way to achieve tolerance and equality. So those are my short observations.
Thank you very much, Karen. I don't know how you pack so much in, but we have a Q&A session coming up, so there'll be an effort to perhaps unpick some of that extraordinarily interesting legal perspective. Roger, to round up the first part of this morning's discussion.
Well, thank you, and hello, everybody. I'd like to thank the Trust and its supporters or sponsors very much for the privilege of being here. I've been to many conferences throughout the world, but this really is very special to attempt to follow the Dalai Lama and to talk about a topic not within an academic context, but within a context which tries to conjoin intellectual understanding with action is a wonderful breath of fresh air for me. I'm here as a token academic. Some of my colleagues would question whether I am an academic. I've worked for a long time at Oxford Brookes University, where I've specialised in the understanding of the psychodynamics or the social preconditions for fascism, and I've spent over 2 decades now trying to refine a humanistic understanding of political intolerance in the form of fascism, Nazism, racist populism, politicized xenophobia, anti-Semitism, totalitarianism, terrorism. My son despairs of all the nasty isms that I deal with. Sometimes it's shorthand, I just say I teach nasty isms. Now, the central focus of my work, which is the element that makes my credentials academically rather dubious in some quarters, is that is a premise about human nature and the human need for what could be called a sacred canopy or an overarching worldview or what the Italians call a vision of the world, una visione del mondo, or out intellectualize intellectuals, nomos, a total law-giving vision of things. And the premise of much of my work is that human beings need this cultural framework, which is not necessarily a healthy one in terms of tolerance, as the Aztecs, who used to sacrifice captured warriors to keep the fifth sun going, demonstrates all too clearly. I mean, culture is not necessarily tolerant or good. But nevertheless, without a nomos, my premise is human beings can behave in very erratic and irrational ways. And when a societal framework collapses, as it did very dramatically in Germany with the double whammy of the loss of the First World War and then the Wall Street crash of 29, you can have collective lemming-like disorientation, which can suddenly make a tailor-made total worldview, as offered by Nazism and incidentally by communism at the time, attractive in a way which looks very irrational to the outside, but extremely rational to the people who are within that bubble. And so I'm very interested in the way certain crises can actually create the conditions in which people will have a need, a deep existential need for a new nomos, which has the collateral damage of discriminating against, persecuting out-groups. So I'm very interested in this relationship between a sense of secular or religious salvation within an extreme, or something you might call it, fundamentalist view of the world on the one hand, but the cost to the demonized other, as it's so neatly called, the excluded other, which is the cost of having this wonderful sense of finding salvation, secular or religious. Now, I'm particularly interested in the rebirth myth, but I won't bore you with that. The book that is, I'm a bit of self-advertising now, a book coming out in September gives you a sort of flavour of my sort of work, which is, it's called Terrorists Creed, Fanatical Violence and the Human Need for Meaning, and it relates not just ancient terrorism, Sicari and the assassins, but the various forms of modern terrorism directly to a very profound human need for a total meaning-giving framework, which can be more important than life itself, literally. If you analyze the psychodynamics of a martyr bomber, as far as you can follow empathetically people flying aeroplanes into the Twin Towers, that is an incredible act of faith on one hand, but of course it is a catastrophic misdirection of spiritual energies to an outsider. Now, my only claim to legitimacy here is that 2 years ago I gave a keynote to a rather different conference on set up by a newly a foundation called the Parental Foundation, and it was on global humanism. And I gave a talk then in which I developed a thesis, and I wanted to call these thoughts tolerance and intolerance, two intertwined human narratives. What I tried to create a thought picture of in that talk was that we're very familiar, and I make a living out of the very familiar narrative, the narrative of the human history as a series of catastrophes, of wars, persecutions, imperialism, civilizations coming and going, all sorts of weird and wonderful and horrible forms of discrimination. But there's almost like a DNA double helix. Intertwined with that narrative of exclusion and extremism is another narrative, which is very difficult to get people. I mean, we ran at Oxford Brookes a course on Jack the Ripper and another one on evil, and they're flooded out. But if you talk, if you gave a course on niceness, or Jack, the guy who made up with his wife and didn't have an affair or brutally whatever, then people don't tend to turn up. But the other narrative, this, which I believe to be absolutely as ancient as the narrative of war, is one of what I call, and here's my concept I want to launch onto, transcultural humanism. Now, humanism has been appropriated by radical, I would even call some of them fundamentalist atheists, who say, there is no God, there is no God, but we have this thing called humanism, which for me is a very illogical leap from Darwinism. How you go from Darwinism to humanism, that it might make sense up the Banbury Road in Oxford, but it is quite a big leap of faith. What this second narrative I'm talking about actually shows that human beings genetically, socially, have an innate capacity for doing exactly what Dalai Lama was talking about so magnificently this morning, and who could try to emulate his wonderful blend of wisdom and humour, which is the fundamental recognition of the oneness of humanity. And if you look at the history of dance, the history of cooking, the history of religion, the history of language, the history of genetics, you will find that humanity has constantly been interrelating, interconnecting, intertwining, and creating new syntheses out of that interaction. And that has only been possible because of a very powerful, apart from the selfish gene, which may occasionally be selfless to be selfish, there's also, I believe, if you're going to talk genetics, there's also a selfless gene, which is absolutely fundamental to survival and to all those wonderful things about a sense of love and peace and calm and compassion. And rather than give it out in my own impoverished words, I'd like to quote Salman Rushdie's Imaginary Homelands, which is ironic because he's talking about a book that got him delivered with a fatwa at his door, Satanic Verses, and these are the terms in which he describes the central characters of his book. Standing at the centre of the novel is a group of characters, most of whom are British Muslims, or not particularly religious persons of Muslim background, struggling with just the sort of great problems of hybridisation and ghettoisation, of reconciling the old and the new. Those who oppose the novel most vociferously today are not of the opinion that intermingling with a different culture will inevitably weaken and ruin their own. I am of the opposite opinion. Those people think that intermingling will ruin their culture. The Satanic Verses celebrates hybridity, impurity, intermingling, the transformation that comes of new and unexpected combinations of human beings, cultures, ideas, politics, movies, songs. It rejoices in mongrelization and fears the absolutism of the pure. Mélange, hodgepodge, a bit of this and a bit of that, is how newness enters the world. It is the great possibility that mass migration gives the world, and I have tried to embrace it. The Satanic Verses is for change by fusion, change by conjoining. It is a love song to our mongrel selves. Throughout human history, the apostles of purity, those who have claimed to possess a total explanation, have wrought havoc among mere mixed-up human beings. Like many millions of people, I am a bastard child of history. Perhaps we all are, black and brown and white, leaking into one another, as a character of mine once said, like flavours when you cook. Now, I have used a half sabbatical granted by the Brendel Foundation for the last year to launch, or try to launch, yet another project. This is called PATH, a project for the advancement of transcultural humanism. And without taking up any more discussion time, what it's working on is precisely, it seems, resonant with what we heard this morning and what I take the foundation to be to do with. I believe that, in a way, millions and millions of people in their daily lives and in their proactive activities are overcoming the racial boundaries, ethnic boundaries, all sorts of of prejudice, but they lack a sense of being part of a world movement. We can see all the chaos, we can see all the results of the opposite, of discrimination, exclusion, etc., etc. But I believe that whether you're working for Médecins Sans Frontières or you're just trying to work in your local community towards greater understanding, we are all part of a great historical movement, a countervailing discourse, a countervailing movement to exclusion and intolerance. And this has an actual academic basis if you look at genetics and psychology and anthropology and history, and it also has incredible implications for the way all these different initiatives, which are countervailing the destruction of the planet in all its various forms, can actually feel themselves part of a huge movement working locally but acting globally in a cumulative way. And what I'd like to dedicate the closing years of my own academic career to is not the nasty-isms, but a nice-ism, transcultural humanism. I'd like to believe that people can feel within whatever faith they're in, unless they're Aztecs, that their own religion contains within it the possibility of articulating proactive, moderate, positive tolerance of the sort that was so eloquently talked about this morning. And though it will be configured and articulated with a different vocabulary, and not just a Western secular J.S. Mill vocabulary, it will all be part of a linking up. And I know that's a bit hippie, and it's a bit hippie, but what thrills me, being so old, is in the 60s you turned on and dropped out and you thought, wow, man. And now the fruit of that generation, and I hope to be partly part of that fruit, not the one that came after all that terrible Holocaust, but part of that, is that idealism has now got teeth and part of the male anatomy, and it's out there actually trying to activate it through law, through legislation, through action, and I feel very privileged to be part of this event. Thank you very much.
Roger's obviously fed up being Mr. Nasty, and he's now going to spend the rest of his life as Mr. Hippie Nice. I mean, the kids are going to be completely confused. Now, there's been a tremendous knitting together of all of that, and I don't want to do what you've already got in your own heads. We've got 15 minutes or so, perhaps slightly less. I'd like to, I'd like to use our platform as a kind of resource. But I want you to think yourselves, and I want you to think about tolerance in a just and fair society. I want to hear, inevitably, these sorts of things always briefly, preceded by your name and affiliation, and I'll push you on that, and we have microphones wandering around, about what it so far you've taken from this extraordinary morning in terms of understanding tolerance and resistance and active intellectual work. So let's see if we've got some hands that want to get us started. There's a lady just down here. I'm going to take a few. I might come to the platform, I might not, to be perfectly honest with you. You get us started, madam, and just tell us who you are, and a comment is fine at this stage, or a question.
This is a woman for justice and peace in Sri Lanka. I am extremely sad to say that the Dalai Lama has been prevented from entering Sri Lanka by this government for many years, and some Buddhist monks have been standing in the way of the resolution of the 64-year conflict. They are the cause, and that is terrible.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll take that as a comment. Thank you. Do we have any more? We have this one of our scholars, I think. Is that right? Very good. Claim priority. Anybody at the back up here want to have a comment? And that lady who's just caught my eye. So we'll take these two.
My name is Ivana Radacic. I'm from Croatia. I'm a scholar, and I'm a human rights academic and activist working primarily on women's rights in Croatia. So basically, it's just a comment. It's actually a fascination of what has happened here. When I saw the title of the conference, I was like, tolerance? I don't know. Is that, what we should be talking about? Is that what the just and fair society demands? Is it enough? As you, Lord Parek, said, basically it presupposes the idea of intolerance, so I thought we have to move. And when I was thinking without listening to you, I thought, okay, equality is what we have to infuse this idea with. And also because tolerance was actually linked to military, or intolerance was linked with the military ways of solving it, which have not really been appropriate means, and I know it as well from being born in the former Yugoslavia. And so then we went to equality in the courts and we saw problems with that, to end up, I think, greatly with what we started the thing with kind of spirituality. And I think this is what we need today. We need basically to move from even law or to connect law with the idea of this, the oneness of the humanity. And I was just glad to see, you know, this transition here, and this is basically my comment. I'm glad that thank I was you. Here and got this kind of conjunction of all these together.
Thank great, you. Thank you very much. That's really the kind of thing we want. I'm very helpful. I've got the lady with the microphone and the gentleman who's already caught my eye, who's now going to show himself, and that lady there. So we'll try and keep the microphones moving fairly quickly between people. Madam.
My name's Catherine Buckle. I'm doing an MA at King's College in Religion and Contemporary Society. My question or comment is related to something that was asked to the Dalai Lama earlier about intolerance in India. I don't know if maybe Bhikkhu Parekh can answer this better than anybody else, but what do you think about what the Dalai Lama said was that he thinks that India is inherently actually quite a tolerant society in comparison to what was suggested by the man questioning, because I feel that my opinion is maybe sits somewhere in between the two. So I just wondered okay. what you could say about that.
We'll come to Bhikkhu before the end, and His Holiness was asked a question about India, and that was the nicely summarised response. Sir, and then the microphone down to this lady here.
Might I just comment?
And you are?
I'm Alan Hayes. I'm from Leicester. I'm a humanist. I'm a secularist and all the otherists.
Okay, I didn't want too many of them. One will do. Thank you very much, Alan. One of the trans cultural humanists for you, I think. Why don't you start with there? We've got this lady here, and then we've got the lady who caught my eye in the middle. Put your hand up again. Put your hand up again. There, yes, but thank you.
Hi, my name's Rachel. I'm a student at LSE. I have two quick questions. I think perhaps they can be answered by anyone. The first is, what do you think are the limits of tolerance? I think you all accept that there are limits to tolerance. I think Mill would maybe say harm. We can intervene to prevent harm, but that's obviously a problematic concept in itself. And the second question is there maybe a logical contradiction in the whole idea of tolerance? I'm talking about the second nice type of tolerance, by the way, that the Lord Parekh mentioned, the tolerance where we don't judge other people. Is there a contradiction in that? Because tolerance is itself a philosophy, a way of life. The idea that we don't interfere with other people is a philosophical conviction that we're then imposing by saying we should not interfere with other people. So,
thank
yeah.
you very much, Rachel. I think we'll take one more before we go to the panel. A lot of hands up, I'm afraid, but this lady has the microphone, which is, I'm afraid, an advantage in this brutal world.
So, in other words, non-gentle judgmental tolerance and related to.
Nice and loud into the microphone, or possibly they'll help you turn it on.
We're not judging.
It's become less of an advantage than I had earlier anticipated.
Hi, my name is Prakriti. I'm doing the LLM in LSE. And my question, I'm a little troubled. I seem to be the only one troubled by the burqa ban in France. And I want to know what the panel about tolerance, just and fair society, that would be France, and how it's not an infringement of personal space, personal religion, personal choice, and how is that balanced, the burqa ban in France, basically.
Thank you very much. Super. I mean, we have time after lunch. We're coming back. We've got a free-flowing session with the scholars where we'll develop some of these points. And the idea is to develop a kind of momentum about ideas through the day. I'm going to ask the panel to a greater or less extent, to deal with the questions in particular, I think. Karen, I might start with you, perhaps on that last point particularly, and because certainly there's some interest in some of what you said, and then we'll take Jonathan and Roger as a way of tidying up. So, Karen.
I can't remember who asked the question, so I've... Oh, hi, sorry. Yes, on the burqa ban in France, in fact, I've just done an intervention, a legal intervention in the case, which is now before the European Court of Human Rights. And it is, it's driven, I'm afraid, by racism towards certain minority communities. The effect of it, because it's a complete ban in public spaces, is to imprison women. And whatever one has, whatever one's feminist views are about the burqa and other forms of gendered manifestation of religious rights, that cannot be a proper way to address freedom and liberation for women. So it's very problematic, and as I say, it's not driven by any liberal views about women and feminism.
Thank you very much. Bika, do you want to take up the India point, which we've heard, and also possibly limits to tolerance and contradictions in the notion of tolerating? All in, I think, about 35 seconds.
Well, on the Dalai Lama thing, since I wasn't here in the morning, I wasn't quite sure what you said about India. So I'm not quite sure how to respond to that. So you'll forgive me if I simply skip the question, unless you tell me.
Well, I think we'll move on. But essentially, he was resisting the temptation to agree with the speaker, who was quite critical of what the speaker described as levels of intolerance within India. And it'd be fair to say, I think, without getting too much into the memory of it, His Holiness played fairly, in a cricket analogy, straight bat, and actually ended up sort of celebratory of India. And I think perhaps our questioner is wondering about whether you might spontaneously share that position. And Roger, come in a minute, but we'll take this from Bhikkhu first, I think, because you've got the other two points. But if you feel that's not enough to respond, just move on to the other question from Rachel.
Yes, I think I don't think I want to say very much about India. At one level, I think the Dalai Lama is right in saying that there is a level of intolerance. But on the whole, I think India has been able to manage it reasonably well. And one can start looking at the variety of religious traditions in India, such as the Hindu and the Buddhist and others, and how from within those traditions there are resources of tolerance which are increasingly being mobilized. So that's apart from those rather general remarks. I don't think I would very much want to say very much about India. On the two questions that were raised here, limits of tolerance and how far can you be non-judgmental? Large questions, but very quick response would be, limits of tolerance, I think, ultimately will have to be set in terms of two things. First, are there certain universal principles for which we can make a reasonably compelling case? In other words, those principles without which no conceivable form of good life is possible. If we can, and I have argued that we can, enunciate certain moral principles. I mean, human rights that you have been talking about, although my list of human rights would be slightly thinner than the one that you chefs operate with, or the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights talks about. But it's possible to arrive at certain universal principles like non-killing, respect for human dignity, basic equality, and so on. And one would say these are the principles where the line has to be drawn. But that is never enough. It's all right for a public platform, but when you are legislating or when you are engaged in a public debate, let's say in parliament or elsewhere, this is never enough, because no society is based on or can be based on abstract, minimum, universal principles alone. It has a history. It has a character. It feels protective about it. And therefore, it's perfectly possible for the society to say, this is our cultural and moral identity. It is being undermined by people through a variety of practices, which we will not tolerate. Now, if you look at the current debate in Europe, that's precisely about that. It's not about universal principles. It is about historically inherited cultural identity of a community. In France, for example, when they talk about laïcité, all the big case that came up in the German Constitutional Court, where a student called Firashta Lodin appeared before a class wearing a scarf, and the German said, look, I'm sorry, but you know, in France it is the student wearing a hijab, in Germany it was the teacher. Now the matter went right up to the Constitutional Court, and the Constitutional Court said, you may not wear a hijab, a teacher may not. Now, two things to be, on terms of abstract right, I have a right to display my religion, manifest my, fine. But your right to manifest your religion must be consistent with and must take a form which are consistent with the history and tradition. And in our tradition, we have learned, as they argue in the case of France, that school is the only agency through which we create a common shared identity. And therefore, wherever else you may exhibit your differences, in the school, you may not. Because in our history, this is the only terrain left. So my answer, to, and again, there are arguments for and against it. We don't have the time to go into it. But I would simply say that I would set the limits of tolerance, A, in terms of certain universal principles, and B, in a rather complex kind of argumentation, through the history and traditions of a particular community. And on the question of being non-judgmental, I mean, I know it might this raises some important questions. I thought the question might be asked on that. I gave you the example of someone saying, I have a gay couple living next door, but I tolerate. Now, here a judgment is being made. A non-judgmental response would be, it is none of my business. And the question would be, is it not possible to say that certain forms of human relationships or the way in which people live are only of concern to those involved, and therefore others should not be involved? In other words, some kind of distinction between private, civic, and public stroke political. I mean, that as long as you are prepared to concede that some such distinction is possible, then you have to allow space for non-judgmental approach to others. Things that belong to the private realm are entirely your personal matters. Others should not be making judgments on them.
Thank you, and thank you. Very quickly, Roger and Jonathan.
And just one example. I mean, I could be easily judgmental.
It's a very quick example.
and I pause. When Conor, for example, had this Dalai Lama's garment wrapped up in his pocket, or you were carrying it in your
This is an exaggeration.
I did something similar yesterday when His Holiness gave it to me. And a member of his entourage was very deeply upset. And he said, Professor, you don't do that. And I said, what does it mean? He said, if it is not only a holy object, like not just it's a cross or a crucifix, but it is given to you by the Dalai Lama himself, blessed by him, put round your shoulder. It's a holy object, and therefore you should be treated with the same degree of love and care and respect as you would treat any other. So I said, what do I do with it? He said, you can't put it in your briefcase.
And I was very grateful for that.
But he was tolerant enough. Now, was he right to be judgmental? I think he was. Because it's not a private matter, it's a public object.
And that was a very helpful conversation on the way here with people. Roger and Jonathan?
One thought comes to mind. That is that, I mean, you know, limits of tolerance are legal limits on what you can do and what you can say and so on. Interest me greatly because obviously as a journalist, freedom of speech is a crucial matter. But I think an even more important area often is what is beyond the bounds of decency and what is seen in the society as being beyond the pale. My own academic research many years ago, I did on the French National Front. I think it's striking the difference between Britain and France. In Britain, the far right is seen as being very much, by and large, beyond the pale. It's rather strange gentlemen in raincoats who like Adolf Hitler. Whereas in France, the political traditions are very different. I think a nationalist far right in France is by no means seen as beyond the pale in the same way. And it's not just the existence of extreme right-wing parties and so on. And gracious, you know, we've seen now in Greece and all of them. Struck by the Dalai Lama's comment about inner strength leading to self-confidence, leading to tolerance. I think much the same for individuals goes for societies at large. And we go through a period where I think supreme lack of confidence. resurgence of the far right in Greece and indeed in France. And what worries me most is not that these parties are going to come to power, but I think in the French case it's instructive that you see that these parties have a very strong influence on the terms of the debate. I would argue, I would go so far as to say that in France the terms of the debate on immigration have almost entirely been set by the National Front over the last three decades. And that the boundaries between extremist parties and what we would call more mainstream parties are very, very fluid. And we've seen this most recently in France in the in the recent elections, where in many ways, I suppose, I want to say sadly, the profile of the voters of many of the mainstream conservative parties are really very little different to those of the National Front. And, you know, in some parts of the country, they're getting 30, very close to 40% of the vote in some constituencies. So I think, you know, it's that sense of, you know, yes, what is legal that's important, but also what collectively we say, well, you can say those things, but frankly, we hold you beyond the pale if you do say
thank
that.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much. I mean, this is an amazing set of connections here between what we heard just now in the morning and this afternoon. Now, what's happening now, we're 5 minutes after, but the stewards are going to help you get there. It's a beautiful room, as I said, sixth floor of the old building, which is across the way. Lunch, and I want you back here at 2 o'clock. It's not 2 o'clock-ish, it's 2 o'clock. And I all want you back here because this is the heart of the conference, is the presentations leading to the discussion about intolerance from the scholars. Thank you very much. Can you, before you walk out, give them a tremendous round of applause.